I will do so.
And I might take a few pictures. That's okay.
I don't mind.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Got it. Well, thank you.
Okay.
No worries.
Thank you all for coming. For me, it's really unusual, and in fact, I feel honored to be able to teach it at Zen Center. I've been doing this off and on for now 20 years, actually. I'm just reflecting on that. Not quite, like 19 years. But it's been interesting for me, because when I first came here, I started teaching about perfection of wisdom and Nagarjuna, and that was a relatively unknown kind of thing to be doing at the time. And then Monday night, there was a class here on recovery and meditation practice, and it was being taught by, I forgot his name.
Jeffrey.
And in the course of talking about recovery, Jeffrey read some little passage from Daily Dharma, 365 passages to think about one a day, and it was on perfection of wisdom. And he sort of rattled off a, well, this is what it means, kind of response off the cuff. And I thought, well, now I don't have anything else to say. So he's kind of done it. And it was sort of an indicator to me about the way things have changed at Zen Center, in kind of interesting fashion. So let me start off actually by telling you a little bit about myself and why I'm doing this, which I think some of you know me and some of you don't, so that's kind of a good thing to begin with. Who is it that's talking here? And I hope I'm talking loud enough. I just don't talk very loudly anymore. And I get hoarse a lot, so I drink a lot of water. So. By training, I am a scholar, and we were just talking about Bloomington. I went to graduate school at Indiana University in Bloomington and did a doctorate in Tibetan quite a long time ago now, as it turns out. In the very beginning, I was interested in Nagarjuna. And one of my teachers there said, if you want to know anything about Buddhism, you have to know about Nagarjuna. I said, okay, that's fine. I guess that's what I'll do my dissertation on. And then he promptly disappeared to Mongolia for a year, kind of left me in the lurch. But anyway, in fact, I did begin doing some research on Nagarjuna. And what I've been doing since that time is just a whole lot of different things: teaching university courses, living in monasteries, being a university administrator, publishing some books, this kind of stuff. But Nagarjuna and Nagarjuna's thought has been with me all during this period of time. And what I thought I wanted to do tonight when we organized this event was not to talk about Nagarjuna as the philosopher or the philosophy of emptiness that's embodied in Nagarjuna's treatises, but talk about practicing with Nagarjuna, and in fact speak more to my own experience of what it's like to practice with and live with this person over a number of years, and to share some thoughts with you about that, and then also talk about that, because I'm sure there will be some questions and curiosity. And we only have an hour, fortunately. I say fortunately because I still teach universities. I still teach at universities, but I only do it online. I haven't done live teaching for a really long time because I'm having some difficulties with my voice. And I don't know if I can talk for an hour, so we'll see how this goes. It's actually kind of a question. So a couple things. First off, I thought it would be really very helpful, and I thought that this particular class was mostly going to be folks who live here at Zen Center. So what I did was I went down to the library and I grabbed a whole bunch of books that I like and that I think are useful, and photocopied the cards from the inside of them with the names of the books and the call numbers to make it easy. If you actually want to read some of this stuff, you can just go down and grab it. And I'll be talking about what these books are. But first, let me tell you who Nagarjuna is. I told you who I am, and many of you probably don't really, except maybe know the name, have a sense of who he is and why he matters. Looks like I'm right. When you recite the names of ancestors here, one of the names that's buried in this large number of ancestors is Nagaharajuna. I think that that's how it is in the list of ancestors, and that's Japanese for Nagarjuna. So he is in the ancestor line of all Mahayana Buddhists in any part of the world, definitely. Let me read from this book one paragraph to tell you a good summary of who Nagarjuna is and why he's important. And this author, Jay Garfield, I'll tell you more about later, wrote the following. Nagarjuna, who lived in South India in approximately the 2nd century of the Common Era, is undoubtedly the most important, influential, and widely studied Mahayana Buddhist philosopher. He is the founder of the Madhyamaka, or middle path schools of Mahayana Buddhism. His considerable corpus includes texts addressed to lay audiences, letters of advice to kings, and the set of penetrating metaphysical and epistemological treatises that represent the foundation of the highly skeptical and dialectical analytic philosophical school known as Madhyamaka. Most important of these is his largest and best-known text, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, literally Fundamental Verses on the Middle Way. This text, in turn, inspires a huge commentarial literature in Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chinese, Korean, and Japanese, and forgot Mongolian. Divergences on interpretation of Mula Madhyamaka Karika often determine the splits between major philosophical schools. And I won't go any farther than this. So, Nagarjuna's place within Buddhist thought is sort of, if you, in the Western sense, if you wrapped up Plato and Aristotle into one person, and maybe threw in Augustine, you'd get Nagarjuna. That really is his place in the Buddhist tradition. He's really the single most important philosopher who's known in the Buddhist tradition. And what he did and what his key activity was, he took all the Perfection of Wisdom sutras and he developed a kind of logical analytic process for understanding what was in the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. So for example, when you recite the Heart Sutra here, if you really wanted to understand the Heart Sutra, you'd be looking at some commentaries. What does it mean to say there are no eyes, there are no ears, there is no nose, no sound, no mind, this kind of thing? If you wanted to understand what that meant, you'd be consulting some commentaries or speaking with some teachers. But ultimately, they would be working their way back through other commentators and other teachers, in fact, to Nagarjuna, who took it upon himself to explain what that meant. Now, the thing, though, that's interesting is that he wrote in verse, in very cryptic, short verses, which are essentially impossible to read and understand. So they always have to be read with a commentary. And because they have to be read with a commentary, and people disagree about what things meant, people come up with different interpretations. So, in fact, although we'll talk about Nagarjuna this evening, if we're going to be honest, we have to say nobody really knows what Nagarjuna had to say. We only have ideas of what we think Nagarjuna had to say based upon what other people think Nagarjuna had to say, based upon what other people think Nagarjuna had to say, based upon, etc. So that's the truth of the situation. So that's kind of ironic. Most important Buddhist philosopher in the Mahayana, we don't really know what he had to say for sure, but we have a lot of literature We have hundreds and hundreds of verses that we know he composed. We just don't for sure know what they mean.
Then how can it be so important if nobody even knows what it means?
I didn't say nobody knows what it means. What I said was everybody has a different idea about what it means, and therefore we're not sure what Nagarjuna said. But, you know, there are many splits in Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist schools of Buddhist thought. And that was the point that Garfield was making, that these different schools of thought come from different interpretations. And let's come back to that. Because then I'll share my own interpretations, and you can say, well, what the heck does that mean? You know, it'd be a good example. So we sort of know, but we sort of don't know. Maybe that's the best way to answer it. I brought some of the books that are on this list, and I thought the first thing I would do, because what I'm going to try and do is do something tonight that will be of value, if it's possible, for everybody, which maybe isn't possible, because there are a lot of different people here with a lot of different kinds of background, and, you know, new to Buddhist practice, been practicing for a really long time, in between, sure they know what's going on, sure they don't know what's going on, so somehow I'm going to see what I can do to try and give everybody something. So first off, I want to talk about some books, because if you want to get kind of serious about studying Nagarjuna, here's some places to start. And if you're living in Zen Center, all of this stuff is downstairs in the library. And the first thing that I would start with is, in fact, this book, which is Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. This one is translated by Jay Garfield. And I want to talk in a minute about its virtues, but I'm also going to speak about this one, Lucid Exposition of the Middle Way, the essential chapters from the Prasanapada of Chandrakirti. And this is translated by Mervyn Sprung. The main teaching, the main text that philosophers and practitioners look at in Nagarjuna and trying to understand his thought is what's called the Fundamental Stanzas on Wisdom, with a Mula Madhyamaka Karikas. And as I said, they're very terse. So about 400 years after Nagarjuna's life, the various traditions of trying to interpret and explain the meaning of those stanzas was brought together by an Indian philosopher by the name of Chandrakirti, and he wrote commentary on that. So, because it's essentially impossible to read the stanzas without reading a commentary, this then becomes the fundamental thing to be reading. It doesn't contain all the commentary and all the stanzas, but it contains enough. So it's Chandrakirti's own words, the Sanskrit translated into English, in a very good job indeed, based upon a lot of earlier scholarship. So if you want to read Chandrakirti, if you want to read Nagarjuna directly and understand what the tradition has to say about him, this is a very good place to start. But even Chandrakirti is very difficult to understand, because Chandrakirti was writing in, you know, about 600 AD in India. So you can imagine how, you know, I mean, things have changed. Do we know anything in Western literature that comes from about 600 AD? Augustine maybe is, what, 400, 300? I mean, it's really hard to read stuff that's that old. Right? So even though that's a great place to start, if you want to be serious, there's actually a better place to start, which is this book by Jay Garfield, which is another translation of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, done with under the direction of and with the oral commentary of some very fine Tibetan lamas who are trained in the scholarly tradition. So he just didn't do it on his own. And Garfield is interesting, and there are a number of reasons why I like his book, and I'll recommend it to you. He does have the stanzas in here, which he's translated as lucidly as is possible to do. But then he's written his own commentary on the stanzas based upon what the lamas have taught him. And he's trained as a professional philosopher. He teaches at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. I actually met him a few times when I lived in that area. And he's written a book for Western philosophers who might want to understand Nagarjuna. But he's also written a book just for Westerners who might want to try and understand Nagarjuna. So in fact, I'm going to contradict myself and say this is really the best place to start. And then if you're really interested in Nagarjuna, then you can read this. And that's, these two together are a good foundation, very fundamental. Nagarjuna wrote a number of texts, and some of them are elaborations of things, and some of them are just different texts for various reasons. Of the other texts that he wrote, that other than the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, they're all brought together in this book by Christian Lintner called Master of Wisdom. Lintner is a very classically trained Western scholar. His translations are accurate. He writes for other scholars, unbelievably dry and not all that greatly interesting, but accurate. So if you wanted to check translations, this would be something to do. Now, it's kind of interesting that translating is actually an art. You might think of translating as, well, these are what the words mean in Sanskrit or Tibetan, and then you turn them into English. It's not really what goes on when you're translating, especially not when you're translating an archaic language. There's a lot of interpretation that goes on. So you could say that even if you don't read the original languages, you want to read several translations to sort of triangulate on what the original might have meant. So one thing that's good about this book is that if you look at this with some others, it sort of gives you a little enriched view on things. So even though it's kind of dry, it's accurate in its own way. So you can compare it with other translations, and that's really very useful. One of the things that Nagarjuna did was he wrote commentaries on, commentaries on his own books. Like a certain issue would come up and he would write more about it. So for example, in chapter 7 of the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. Chapter 7 is called Examination Conditioned in this book by Garfield. The last stanza reads like this. Like a dream, like an illusion, like a city of Gandharvas, and Gandharvas are like spirits in the air. So have arising, abiding, and ceasing been explained. This is his conclusion to the previous 7 chapters. He's basically saying everything is like a dream or like an illusion. I think that would be that. It would be over. But actually, he wrote a commentary on that, which ran 70 stanzas long, which brings us to this book by somebody you know, me, which actually started out as my doctoral dissertation in Indiana. And went through a lot of changes and it became this book. And it has its own interesting history. For one thing, the 70 stanzas were written to explain that one stanza about everything being illusion-like. According to Chandrakirti, it was. So I translated that, but this book's virtue, besides the fact that there's an oral commentary that goes with it, this book's virtue, as far as I can tell from talking to people, and it's been in print now continuously since 1987, is I had a chance encounter with a group of psychologists in 1983. In the fall of 1983, I was at Amherst College with Bob Thurman, and we cooked up this idea. I'm sorry, it was fall of 84. Anyhow, we cooked up this idea that we were going to invite the Dalai Lama and a bunch of psychologists to Amherst and have a big conference. It was actually the progenitor of the Mind and Life conferences. So we did that, and we had a very interesting series of things happening. And at the end of that, I was having lunch with some of these psychologists, and they said, you know, we're reading all this stuff about Buddhism, and the scholarly stuff doesn't make any sense to us. And we've read all the popular stuff and it doesn't go deep enough and there's nothing in the middle. And we're kind of interested in something that's sort of in the middle, which is sophisticated, but not for other scholars. And I thought, okay, I got the message. So the first part of this book is putting Nagarjuna's thought in context of meditation practice and that kind of practical dimension to the analysis of Nagarjuna. So some students have found that useful. Most scholars have found it totally useless and said, why did you do that? But the book's been in print for almost 20 years now, so I guess there was a good reason for having done it. So that's my book, and you might find that useful.
Chapter and verse was it's a commentary on?
It's a commentary on the last stanza of the seventh chapter, and I don't know the exact stanza number, but I'll find it for you. Stanza 34 of chapter 7. Like a dream, like an illusion, like a city of Gandharva, so have arising, abiding, and ceasing been explained. Okay, I'm going to talk about two other Nagarjuna texts. He also wrote some general kind of introduction to Buddhist thought, one of which is called Letter to a Friend. And here's a really nice new translation of this, which is oriented toward... it's got a commentary. The idea of the commentary here is for people who are ordinary folks who are trying to understand Nagarjuna and apply it to their lives. How could this make sense? What a great idea. So here we have Nagarjuna's letter to a friend, translated by the Padmakara Translation Group. So this is one of the classics, Letter to a Friend, although it's not all that popular. More popular is something called the Ratnavali, or the Precious Garland, which is a letter to a king. It's also a general overview of Buddhism. This has been translated many times. This particular commentary I really recommend to you very, very highly. In fact, it might even be a better place to start than with anything else, because the commentary on it is by the Dalai Lama, and you can't really get a more insightful, better commentary on anything than Dalai Lama. So I really recommend this to you. This particular translation is by Thubten Jinpa, who is This particular translation on this one is by John Dunn and Sarah McClintock. Anyway, the translation is very good. It's based upon commentary of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, so you can be sure that it has that degree of accuracy. Okay, so much for that. There are two other books that I found particularly helpful in trying to understand Nagarjuna that are not books on Nagarjuna, and I'm going to recommend them to you, and then we're going to stop this and get on to other kinds of things. But I did want to give you this background so you could walk away with something. Dalai Lama has been very, throughout his life, a fan of Shantideva. Now, you may have heard of Shantideva, who's a great Mahayana Buddhist teacher of India. And the one of his key works, called The Bodhisattva Way of Life, has a chapter on wisdom. And this particular book, called Practicing Wisdom, is Dalai Lama's commentary on Shantideva's chapter on wisdom. And it's just totally superb. It's fantastic. And in fact, provides an insight into a lot of the really difficult points that are in Nagarjuna, not necessarily directly addressing Nagarjuna's ideas. So this is also a really inspired and excellent place to begin. Finally, the last one I'll mention is by someone called Geshe Rabten. This is a book called Echoes of Voidness. And the first chapter in this is actually a commentary on the Heart Sutra. And the reason that I recommend this book is that among Tibetans, although Geshe Rabten died in the mid-1980s, among Tibetans, it was said that he had actually experienced emptiness directly. And that's not something that they say lightly. So Geshe Rabten's commentary on the Heart Sutra is based upon his personal direct experience of emptiness. So it has a whole different thrust to it in terms of the kind of subtlety of approach he takes to the Heart Sutra. So, all these things are in the library downstairs, and I recommend them to you.
I'm reading Nagarjuna in Context right now. Actually, I'm slogging my way through the introduction. And I'm are you familiar with that book?
I'm not. Who's the author of it?
I can't remember. It's a new book out about his historical...
Sounds very interesting. If you're slugging your way through it or slogging your way through it, maybe it's not the best choice.
Well, you know, the first part, there's a lot of archaeological evidence, and he's trying to place him
I've heard about this book.
Into, you know, actually the dates that might correspond to his life, since there seems to be, I'm sure, you know, some ambiguity about that. So that's kind of where I'm at, and I'm reading in his background. And so that gets a little dry.
That'd be an interesting thing to do. I wouldn't be sure it's the best place to start, though.
I'm just doing it for my own entertainment, but I just wondered if you were...
I'm not familiar with it. I have heard of it. Now that you're telling me more about it, I knew that there was a book out where somebody was doing that, but I'm not familiar with it myself. I haven't had a chance to look at it. Probably get there. Send me a review. Is there a question over here?
Speaking of the
That's okay. That's okay. I like Stephen. Stephen, I think, I'm actually, the book on my bedside at home that I'm reading right now is a book by Stephen Batchelor. It's called Living with the Devil. It's a very interesting book. I can recommend it to you, actually. The Devil is Mara. Mm-hmm. It's not like... That's somebody else in the Buddhist tradition. But Stephen generally, he's very well trained and very insightful. He's actually a very brilliant person. Personally, I think he tends to lean a little to the nihilistic side sometimes. There's nothing at all wrong with his translating. I don't disrecommend it for any particular reason. These are translations and books that just happen to have resonated with me personally. And Stephen resonates with me personally in other kinds of ways. Rather than as a translator, as someone with a life of experience with Dharma who brings that insight into his writing is the way he mostly resonates with me. And he has a very extraordinary penetrating mind and way of thinking about things. So in that way I really like him. But lately he's been translating mostly on his own. And that's a little sometimes problematic. It's kind of good to stay within the tradition and have lamas who can kick you around when you get it wrong. That's kind of a good thing. Well, I say that because that's what they did for me. They really, literally kicked me around. We do things like we translate the verse and commentary, and then I go back up to my room and I polish it and edit and so on and so forth and bring it back. And Geshe Sonam Rinchen, that I was working with, would ask me some questions about it. And I always got the answer wrong. And he always laughed like crazy. He actually fell off his chair laughing once. Showed my answer was so amusing. So that's good for a scholar to have a teacher who does that to you. It really is. It's not any fun, but it's good. All right. So enough about the books. Let's sort of move on to something else. So, I wanted to focus more beyond giving you those kinds of resources. I wanted to focus more on really what did Nagarjuna talk about? You know, what's the essence of what he was about, and how does that relate to our own practice, which I think is more interesting and a lot juicier. Tibetans say that you can boil all of his arguments about the nature of reality down to three kinds of arguments. You can take all of the stuff and boil it down essentially to three statements. And what those are is that all phenomena, everything you can experience, is empty for one of three reasons. It's empty, and we'll talk about what empty is a little bit. It's empty because it's appearing to be whole when it's actually made up of parts. it appears to be independent when it's actually totally dependent. Or actually, to use Batchelor's term for this, which I've decided I really like, it's contingent. Phenomena are contingent on other phenomena. And all phenomena are empty because they're created through a process of mental designation or labeling. So all of his arguments boil down to those three things. And what that means is anything you can see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or think can be broken down into parts, even though it appears to be a whole when you experience it. Everything, without exception, presents itself as if it's unitary, when in fact it's made up of parts. And its emptiness is that it's empty of its apparent unitary nature. So that's one argument to take care of all phenomena, no exceptions. Everything is contingent or dependent, which is to say that everything arises as a result of causes and conditions. Nothing is independent, nothing exists on its own. Nothing ever looks like it arises out of causes and conditions. It always looks like it's just there. You know, the thought arises in your mind, like, there it is. Well, there's a reason why it came up in your mind, but it never looks like there's a reason. It looks like it's just there, and it's real, and it's compelling. But it always depends on something else. And according to the Asians, the most subtle argument, although I find that Americans find it the most self-apparent argument, is that nothing is what it appears to be, or everything is empty of its own character, because that character was labeled by you. The meaning of that phenomenon, the nature of that phenomenon, the characteristics of that phenomenon entirely depend not on it in itself, but on your mind projecting an idea onto it.
It's the same thing, probably.
Same
thing as labeling, meaning it's all, everything's an abstraction.
Yeah, by a certain kind of interpretation, everything is an abstraction, because what we experience is our concept about things rather than things.
That's either abstraction or close to reification or something.
Right.
Okay.
The philosophical school of thought would be nominalism. Those three things together totally explain Nagarjuna's thought. And it's kind of interesting, then, if you apply this way of thinking to practice, and I don't know how far we want to go into what emptiness means, not that there is some reality behind appearance, which is the great void. Emptiness means that things are empty of or devoid of what they appear to be. It means this book appears to be unitary, but it's actually emptiness, empty of unitariness. It appears to be here on its own, but it's actually dependent upon something else. And it appears to be a book, but actually book is a concept that we have. Thich Nhat Hanh has a great example. He says, can you see the clouds in the paper? If you can see the clouds in the paper, then you see that the book is dependent upon trees, which are dependent upon sun and rain and so on and so forth. But you don't see that when you look at the book. You just see a book. You don't see trees. You don't see paper mills. You don't see truckers. You don't see accountants. You don't see salespeople. You don't see mailmen who, you know, send it to you from Amazon or wherever you got it from. You don't see the trees that were cut down. You don't see the sun shining on the trees. You don't see the rain, any of that stuff. But it's all here, because if any of that stuff was missing, the book wouldn't be here. That's the way in which the book is contingent or dependent on causes and conditions. When you look at the book, you just see one thing, unless I do this. As soon as I do this, you don't just see one thing. You see lots of pieces of paper. Maybe. You might not. You might see one thing sort of fanning. But really, it's just lots of pieces of paper kind of glued together. Oops, some of the pieces just fell out. Right? Looks like a unity, but it's really a multiplicity. It's empty. It's empty of its apparent unity. And I'm not sure I can think of an example of designation in this particular case. But I'm sure, oh, I just got one. It's probably because I live on the Oregon Trail. There are very few examples of guidebooks for how to follow the old trails of the West. Why are there few examples of guidebooks for how to follow the old trails in the West? Because once you got to a certain place and you went beyond it, you didn't need that part of the book. It was just empty. It was just excess weight. So you tore it out and you wiped your butt with it. That's why there are few books that are guidebooks about traveling the Oregon Trail. So what's the difference between a book and toilet paper? Well, it's what you think about it, isn't it? I mean, we would never tear out the pages of a book to wipe our behinds, but the pioneers thought, I'm not going to be back there ever again. I can find something more useful to do with the first part of this book. And so they did. So there are very few original guidebooks. This is a true story. I'm not making this up. This is actually true. Okay. So I said I want to talk about this from the point of view of practice. And I do. I was just really, I was trying to figure out the best way to figure out how to turn all of this into talking about practice. Because really that's it, you know, it only matters from the point of view of one thing. How do you convert this abstract thought, how do you convert this philosophy into something which benefits you and others, which makes you free, which makes you happier, which helps you help other people to be free and happy. If the philosophy doesn't do that, it's just not good for anything except falling asleep at night, because it's hard to read and it knocks you out. Beyond that, it serves no purpose whatsoever. Unless, of course, you're a professor someplace and that's how you make your living. But that's about it, you know. So I was thinking how to do this. And the story, there's a story about Nagarjuna that I'll share with you. And it's considered a legend. It's considered kind of mythic by my academic scholars, scholar friends. But fortunately, since I'm not a tenure track professor, I don't have to care about what they think. And the story goes like this. Nagarjuna is reputed to have been one of the abbots of Nalanda University, which is the great learning center of northeast India. And he used to give his lectures to large numbers of people. And he noticed this unusual thing happening, which was he'd be doing his talks and these two young men would show up and they'd be in the back of this large number of people. And he could smell sandalwood whenever they showed up. And then the lecture would be over and they'd go away and then he wouldn't smell it anymore. Or sometimes maybe they wouldn't show up and he wouldn't smell it. So at a certain point, at the end of one of his lectures, he kind of went over and talked to them and said, what is it that whenever you two guys show up, I smell sandalwood? Like incense, sandalwood incense. And they said, oh, it's because you human beings smell so bad that we have to cover ourselves with sandalwood paste because we can't stand the smell of you. So he said, okay. Who are you? And they said, well, we're Nagas. Nagas are beings that are part serpent and part human. What are the ladies that have fish?
Mermaids.
They're like mermaids, except instead of a fish bottom, they have a serpent bottom. Thank you, mermaids. Getting old sucks. Great example of contingent arising as you watch your mind going away. After cultivating it for so long. Oh well. Yeah. They're like mermaids, except serpents. So they said, we're Nagas, but we're looking like people here. Okay, what are you doing here? He said, well, it was prophesied that many hundred years after the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, some philosopher would show up who was really capable of understanding many Buddhist teachings that no human being can understand, and were entrusted to we Nagas. We've been keeping them in our kingdom in the bottom of the sea, waiting for somebody who would be able to understand them. And we think it's you. You want to come see him? Hey, you know, secret teachings of the Buddha at the bottom of the ocean. Sure, I'll go. So he did. So all the perfection of wisdom sutras, according to the tradition, were being kept by the Nagas at the bottom of the ocean because nobody could understand them. Then Nagarjuna rescued them. In particular, he rescued the 100,000. And presumably all the others are more concise versions of that. That's not actually true, but that's the way the story goes. Anyhow, he brought the perfection of wisdom sutras back, and he began interpreting and explaining them to people. That's why the name Nagarjuna, Nagarjuna. So, I consider this not to be a myth. I consider this to be a true story. This is why I don't have a tenure track position. Well, not why, but you know, I can say things like this, and I don't have to worry about it. But the thing is that it is a story, but it's a story about something that I think is real, but not necessarily in the way in which it might appear to be real. Traditionally, all over the world, the ocean is a metaphor for the mind. Water is a metaphor for the mind. And I personally think that, although it's quite possible he met Nagas and went down to the bottom of the ocean, in fact, in my first trip to India, I found myself traveling with Geshe Rabtan, and he offered to introduce me to a Naga. I didn't take him up on it much too much. That's another story. I was much younger and more foolish at the time. Anyway, going to the bottom of the ocean to find a treasure hidden by the Nagas is another way of saying going deeply into the universal mind to find some teachings that are hidden in the mind and bringing them out of the depths of collective consciousness or collective mind. It's another way of saying this. Which isn't to say he didn't meet some Nagas and go to the bottom of the ocean. Things can happen on many different levels. I think the metaphoric meaning of it is that. So that being the case, when I was trying to figure out what the heck I was going to do here tonight, because this talk was scheduled somewhat after the fact, and then I had to figure out what to do. I used to live in San Francisco, and so I went out to Sutro Heights, because there's a Naga that lives out in Sutro Heights, so I went out there to ask the Naga what I should do tonight. And so he told me to get all these books together. I'm not kidding you. He told me to get all these books together and to talk about experience. So, I said that the Tibetans say there are three arguments for why things are empty. That things are empty of their inherent nature, they're empty of the appearance that they have because they're contingent or dependent, because they're made up of parts and they appear to be whole, and because we designate ideas on them. And those are usually taken as philosophical arguments, but in fact, you can take them as meditation topics. So for the last 15 years, I've taken them as meditation topics. So when you sit in When I'm sitting in meditation, whatever comes up, I look at it. And in the Soto tradition, the idea is it arises, you notice it, you let it go, like clouds that sort of go by, and that's all. But there are other things you can do besides that. When it goes by, whether it's looking at the wall or noticing the guy next to me who's fidgeting like crazy this afternoon, or the flies that are around, or the motorcycles going up and down the street, or the thoughts that I have, or the pains in my knees, or anything like that, because there's all kinds of stuff that comes up when you're meditating, as you all know. You can also look at it and question its character. It presents itself to you as if it's just right there. For example, the guy that was fidgeting next to me this afternoon. It's like, there he is. I'm sitting with my eyes open. I can't not notice the fact there's somebody sitting next to me doing this when he's supposed to be sitting still. So, in my mind, I'm thinking, doesn't he know he's supposed to be sitting still? What is this? You know, when I'm noticing this. Well, his fidgeting had a source. It was contingent. It was dependent upon something. Something was going on. Is he a new meditator? Maybe I'm not being compassionate. Maybe he has an organic problem. He can't sit still, really. And he's doing the best he can. Maybe he's making much more effort to sit still than I am. But he has more to overcome than I do. and that my practice is weak by comparison to his. I don't know that. I don't know the origin of that. I only know there it is. Okay. I don't see the larger whole. I just see that little piece. What is the larger whole? The larger whole is the entire meditation hall full of people sitting there, all doing something, and all influencing each other. I mean, we all sit Zazen. We know that this happened. You sit in the Zendo, and what's going on? What's going on is some stuff with a whole lot of people that's manifesting among different people, including you. So when you have a thought, whose thought really is it? Is it yours? Or did it come from someplace else? Or was it the distillate of the mood of the entire hall that occurred as a thought in your head? Well, you don't know that. So if you're looking at experience analytically, this is the question you would ask. What's the origin of it? You know, what is it made up out of? And then the most important thing is, why are you thinking about it, what you're thinking about it? Why does the guy sitting next to me fidgeting bother me? He wasn't making any noise. He wasn't making any noise at all. Why did it bother me? And what was the kind of the self-righteous crap going on in my head that I thought that there was something wrong with that? Where did that come from? All of that was my projection, my designation onto that behavior. If you analyze in these three ways, every experience that you have just goes poof. It just goes poof. Because what you see, because what I see when I do this, is I see the waves on the surface of the mind, of the collective mind. All this stuff are just waves. I'm just creating this stuff. I'm just creating these fixed forms on the mind. And that what I'm looking at, what I'm really hearing, what I'm really seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, even, is really just the mind with some waves covering it, created by me. And you can dwell in that mind, or I can dwell in that mind. I keep going back and forth. I don't want to be preachy. It's possible to slide into that mind and just be in it and let the waves just go. As they say in Zen, just let the clouds go by. But through this analysis, you can explode every experience and then just go right back into the nature of mind and dwell right in that nature of mind, in that sea that Nagarjuna went into. You can just dwell within it really peacefully and really blissfully. So that really is the whole point of practicing with Nagarjuna, is that there are these tools, these three techniques, or these three technologies for emptying everything of its appearance and getting at what's really going on, which is nothing's going on. So I was meeting with, I think I shared this with somebody, I was meeting with some yogi friends of mine a few weeks ago. It was the 30th anniversary of 35th anniversary of the death of a teacher we shared there, unveiling a statue of him. He was a great yoga master in the Kashmir Shaivite tradition, Kundalini yoga tradition, and they were all talking to me about the great experiences they've been having in meditating and the visions that they have and the light that they see and all this excitement and great stuff. And then it was my turn to talk, and I said, well, I've spent the last 20-some years meditating on emptiness, and when you meditate on emptiness, nothing happens. Cool. Nothing happens. So, that's how to practice with Nagarjuna. Nothing happens. That's it. I don't have anything else to say. If you have questions, I'll try and answer them. Did a lot of talking. I don't usually do that much time. Okay, was he first? Okay.
I just had a brief thing. Would you mind explaining a little bit more by what you meant about the term mind?
You want to tell me more what you mean with your question, so I know how to answer it.
Just, well, a minute ago you were saying, so something to the effect that we can see that everything is mind, basically, or the essential mind.
Okay. This gets at this little comment that I made earlier, or actually Garfield made earlier, is how you interpret certain things, different schools of thought that Buddhist thought spin off of that. So this would be one of those places where different schools of thought would understand this to be different in different kind of ways. Mm-hmm. But what I mean, what I mean by it is that in the Abhidharma tradition, they talk about six senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, actually sense of touch or proprioception also, and mind. Thought is, or mind is the organ that knows thoughts. Okay. Just as the eye is the organ that sees sights, and the ear is the organ that hears sounds. So mind is the organ that perceives thoughts, like subvocal conversation or images that would be in the mind. There's a consciousness of seeing, there's a consciousness associated with hearing, there's a consciousness associated with smelling, and there's a consciousness associated with mental knowledge of thoughts. That consciousness, which is the mental consciousness, is the mind that I'm referring to. And that mind is itself free of thoughts, because it's aware of thoughts. But we experience the two together. We experience just as when you see something, you don't immediately think there's awareness of that wall. You just see the wall. But if you step back and think about it, you can say, well, if my eyes are closed, I can't see anything, so there's an organ involved. There's obviously an object, and there's a consciousness, and those three things have come together. And what I take to be a wall is really a visual representation of something. It's eye consciousness. That I know it's a wall is a thought that's imputed onto that. And the consciousness that's aware of the thought wall imputed on the phenomenon out there is that mental consciousness.
Isn't it back to the nominalism again?
Yeah, it is. Mental consciousness without the thoughts, disconnected from the experience of any object out there, is the mind I was talking about, which in meditation you can free from all that other experience by blowing it up through this analysis. Then that mind in itself can be experienced. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, it's said that the character of mind is that which is luminous in knowing. And so this mental consciousness is described as being luminous in knowing. It has the characteristics of being luminous in knowing. Of course, you have to take that with a grain of salt, because those are just words that are attached to the phenomenon to help identify the phenomenon. But when you're meditating, you can experience that. I'm sure you have experienced that. Most of us have. Sometimes we notice it and sometimes we don't. Sometimes it goes by so fast before the next thought shows up, or the next itch, or the next distraction, that we don't notice it, but it's there. And we can find it. In fact, that's the goal. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, if you can find that, it's not easy to find, but if you can find that mind, which is the mental consciousness, and then hold your attention on it, that you make great progress. I've always felt that that is the Tibetan way of saying Zazen or Dzogchen, is to find that mind and attend to it, focus on it, dwell in it. I've always felt that that was the same thing, that that's what they're doing. Personal.
The same thing as just sort of letting go, receiving, letting go, what you were speaking of.
Yeah, sort of dwelling in, you could call it pure subjectivity, mm-hmm. without the distraction of anything else. It's really hard to do because you're always asking yourself, is that what it is? Am I there? Is that the mind? And as soon as you do that, you've lost it, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you say, oh, wait, stop thinking that. Oh, you're thinking that thought, stop thinking that. And then you stop doing all that stuff, and then you're there for a flash. You're just there, aware, not of anything in particular, and then sure enough, something else comes up, and you're going to go down the garden path again.
David?
Yeah.
There's a quote that I got from the internet that goes, that refers to this, it goes, if thoughts move, let them. If there is no movement, don't look for it. No, if thoughts move, let them. Movement arises and is liberated without a trace. If there is no movement, don't look for it. This is empty luminosity, naked, empty awareness. Practice without the destruction or cultivation of thoughts brings the accomplishment of the destruction of hope and fear. Now, you mentioned analyzing to come to that place. So that's a little bit different.
Not really. It actually isn't. Because when you begin the process, it's kind of rational, kind of analytic, but after a while, you can just look at it and see it. This afternoon, when I was sitting out in the courtyard, thank you, I was sitting out in the courtyard, and he came out and said, do you mind if I sit down? And I said, sure, that's fine. He said, what are you doing? I said, I was looking at those brooms. That's what I was doing. I was looking at those brooms. I wasn't doing anything in particular, but I was looking at the brooms, and I was seeing that somebody had left them there, the way they were all sort of stacked. If I could see, I mean, I wasn't thinking about it, but I could see the brooms were just, they didn't just get there. You know, there'd been somebody, you know, I could see that. And I could see that they're made up parts. I mean, I just didn't see one thing. And I could see my mind thinking broom, rather than, you know, I mean, it was all there. So that's what was going on. But there wasn't any analysis that was going on. But I was seeing that. Because you go from analysis, you go to this rational process to just directly, there it is. It's what you see, it's what you notice. And as long as you're seeing and noticing it, as long as you're seeing and noticing it, then it's kind of different at that particular point. And then you're just sort of in there with it, and everything is very sharp. Very, I don't know how to say this, it's thus, it's that, it's just there. Here it is.
Luminous?
Yeah, well it is, it was. It was. You know, it was all of that. The other thing that I didn't say is that the reason I never wasn't clear about this, when I say that this is all mind, I don't mean in the sense it's created by mind. There is a world. We don't experience it. What we experience is our ideas about the world. We construct the world mentally, and we experience our ideas about it, and that's what we experience. And so in Zazen, you can try and not have that experience. But as soon as you stop doing Zazen and you go through the rest of everything, that's all back there. So you can also walk around and you can recognize that you're mentally creating all your experience and that that's okay. I'll use another metaphor for this. This is getting obscure. You're driving across the desert. You see a mirage. Looks like there's a lake out in the Mojave Desert. You know there's no lake on Highway 80 in the desert. You know the Highway 80 doesn't drive through any lakes, doesn't drive over any lakes, doesn't drive around any lakes. There are no lakes there. You look down the highway, there's a lake. That's a mirage. You keep on driving, it's gone. No lake there. No. Is that a hallucination? A hallucination is a creation of something out of nothing, something that totally doesn't exist. No, it's not. It's a mirage. A mirage is something that is one thing but appears to be another thing. It's really heat waves on the asphalt. It appears to be water. It's a mirage. So, it's a real mirage. It's really there as a mirage. It's totally not there as a lake. It's totally there as a mirage. It's totally not there as a lake. Okay. So all of this stuff is totally here as a mirage. It's totally not here as what it appears to be. But it's really here as a real village of Gandharvas, as a real illusory something. It really is here. So the brooms were really there as something totally other than what they appear to be. But they were really there as totally other than what they appear to be. Does that make any more sense?
David, is it?
Wait, who's next? Well, unless you had a question about the mirage thing.
I do.
Okay.
Do
you mind?
Is it that they're not here as what they appear to be, or are they not here as what we call them?
Same thing. What they appear to be is what we call them.
Thank you.
They only appear to be what we call them.
Okay.
So, if we start seeing things and not believing that the way we see them is the way they actually are, you know, you're saying it's kind of kind of liberates you. I find it kind of makes me nervous or like uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yes, it does, doesn't it?
So does this liberation come like? I mean, I also felt like I also had kind of liberating experience with that, and it helps me like not being be like it helps me be a little more understanding of the person pitching next to me maybe. But and so ethically, I can see it helps, but it makes me uncomfortable, and it makes me like not sure of, well, if the way I think isn't the way things are, then how do I know, you know, do I have to make my best guess? So it's kind of an uncomfortable feeling, so
yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, Nagarjuna talks about that. He says, this will make you uncomfortable. He says, if you're getting it, it'll make you uncomfortable. And then one of two things will happen. You decide you don't want to be uncomfortable and you run away. Or you decide that you put up with it until it stops making you uncomfortable.
You just get used to that feeling of the mystery and knowing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You get to the place of being okay with mystery. But that's actually wonderful. It opens up all kinds of possibilities. People turn out to be totally different than who you think they are. Life turns out to be totally different than what you expect it to be. A lot of good things happen, a lot of bad things happen, just the way it is, you know. But what happens and what you experience is more open and more real, because where problems occur is with your predisposed notions about the way things are going to be. When I signed up to come out here and do a class, it was to do a class on Saturday called Workplace Wisdom. You know, we're talking about all this kind of stuff in work, in jobs. Because my life has been working as an administrator. And so the question for me has always been, how do you apply this in ordinary, practical kind of situations? I mean, the job that I have now, I'm responsible for 160 university professors who teach 1,000 classes a year. That's complicated. That's a lot of work. And if I have assumptions about what's going on, I usually get into trouble. For example, students write me and they complain about faculty members. I've long since learned that the students aren't right, but the students aren't wrong. And that the faculty members aren't right when they say the students are wrong, but the faculty members aren't exactly wrong either. That the reality of what's going on is totally different than anything I think it is or they think it is. And when I have to adjudicate problems between faculty and students, that's a very good attitude to have. It's much easier to assume that the consumer is right because he bought this product called an education and isn't satisfied with it. Or it's much easier to assume that the professor's right because he's got the PhD and what does the student know? And those are kind of easy ways out, but the truth of the matter is that I have no idea what's going on, and probably neither do they. So this attitude of mystery, well, I'm serious, this attitude of mystery actually makes it possible then for me to try and determine what's going on in the situation. Now, if I didn't think that the village of Gandharvas was a real mirage, I wouldn't be able to do anything with it. So what I understand myself doing is trying to figure out what's the texture of the mirage there that they're all disputing about. And since I know it's a mirage, I know it's kind of going to do this. I'm being kind of metaphoric now. I don't assume it's a this, and that we're going to get to the that, and we're going to know it, and somebody didn't get it. You see what I'm saying?
Alan Watts is like the wisdom of uncertainty or something like that.
Maybe that's what he meant. Yeah, maybe so. I think I read it a long time ago, and I don't remember. But that's the idea. That was the idea. And Nagarjuna says that this teaching will make you uncomfortable. That's a good sign. Don't worry about it. 30 minutes from now, you won't have forgotten it. You have to work at keeping yourself uncomfortable. It takes a lot of effort to keep yourself uncomfortable.
I've been trying.
You had a question in the back, and I kind of rattled on past you. What was that?
It more or less answered it, but I was just wondering to ask if you were talking about with the grooms, how you saw them in the famous more or less pole. And I was wondering if you ever, ever put it in the opposite direction, to be deconstructed as kind of being a set that you hear a bird and you try it or you hear a sound and you might say that sound comes from a bird and then you say it's maybe trying to just hear the sound by associating with the thought of the bird.
Yeah, you could do that. That would be sort of directly experiencing the sound. excuse me. This is why I teach on the internet these days rather than teaching live. You could also do something else, though. Well, I do something else anyway, and you might want to do something else, which is just as you can know that the bird is not whole in the sense that it's composed of parts. You could also see that the bird is not independent in the sense that it exists within a context, which is a larger context. So, if I'm sitting in Zazen, for example, downstairs, usually what I'm feeling is the presence of all the minds in the meditation hall, which all link up with each other as one collective mind, and that collective mind has waves on it, the currents that are created by the larger mind around it of San Francisco and the times that we live in and the history that everybody brings, that those and the natural forces of the times, that all that stuff is affecting us as we're all sitting in Zazen. So we're like this one big quivering mass of jello, sometimes is the way I see it. Sitting in Zazen together. Now that's a very, it's not really what you're supposed to do, I know, when you're sitting in Zazen, but it's what I do. I can get away with it because, I'm a Vajrayana Buddhist, so I get a lot of weird, a lot of stuff. I'm not a Soto Zen Buddhist. Even though they let me practice here. But what that does is that fosters relationship. When you see that bird in relationship to a larger whole, where you see yourself, where you experience yourself in relationship to a larger group of individuals. I mean, we're Mahayana Buddhists. And Mahayana is about the collective enterprise of everybody moving everybody forward in a positive evolutionary way together. You can't do that if you're just doing your own thing. But if you're sitting in the Zendo and a thought comes up, and the thought that comes up, you don't identify as your thought. You just identify it as the thought that entered the Zendo from heaven only knows where. If you see that that's an unwholesome thought, and you can convert it, you can take the energy out of it, blown up, whatever you want to call it, digest it, turn it around into something positive, not get caught by it, but change it so that the person sitting next to you doesn't get caught by it when it's zooming on by. Then you've done them a favor too, because then they don't have to deal with it because you dealt with it. So that's real Mahayana. It is.
You what know, if it's the taking, thought's a bliss thought?
Well, then that's great. Then you want to send it on its way. That's discrimination. Yeah, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. No, I mean it is. I was sitting in the Zendo yesterday afternoon, and I was sort of feeling everybody around me, and was thinking, God, how incredibly fantastic that here's this group of people sitting Zazen, making their minds quiet together in the middle of this freaking craziness of San Francisco, right? What a fantastic thing that we're all here doing this wonderful thing that nobody else in this city has the sense to do. Isn't that great? And I just felt this incredible kind of expansive, warm, loving feeling for everybody, and I thought, well, that's wonderful, and everybody should be included in that. And that's real Mahayana, to include everybody in that feeling. So really, yes. So that stuff happens too. You talk to people at Tassajara, you know this stuff happens. Everyone's sitting there and it happens. So those Zen Buddhists just don't like to talk about it very much. But, you know, I mean, if we are all in it together, and we all have to kind of cooperate in a way of taking care of each other, we will make things forward. Like the people here who are concerned about and are taking care of Blanche. Just an example of it in a very concrete kind of way. Here's an example of one kind of abstract. You know, I say it's not Soto, but think of all of what goes on. The prayers and the chants. You know, we appreciate the ancestors. We appreciate the deceased patrons of the temple and all this kind of stuff. It really is the same thing. It's not always just being extreme on this.
And seize the opportunity to mention another chance to share. As most of you know, David came out here to lead the class on Saturday. Since most of us are going to the funeral, David added this class. So this is by donation. And there's a basket on that table for donations. I know, and all of that goes to David.
No, none of it goes to David. All goes to Zen Center.
Oh, well then.
No, it all goes to Zen Center.
Oh, well, if you want to give Zen Center money. Those of us who live here are just dying to give Zen Center money. Okay, skip it. Thanks very much.
No, I had no idea when to put the basket after the vessels. None of it comes to me. That's not.
Okay.
No, it's for me, it's really, it's... It really is a privilege to be able to sit here and talk to you. It really is. I'm very honored to be able to do that. They'll say I don't get to talk with practitioners. They'll say I get to talk with students who quibble about. I missed that B by 5 points. There's something wrong with this professor. I really do.
So do we all get an A tonight?
No grades, thank goodness. Are there more questions? Anything else off the wall that I said that you want to know about? I thought some of this stuff was kind of off the wall. Yes?
So in your book, did you get comments by psychologists? Were they helpful? I mean,
yeah.
Is that what you got? Is that what sort of inspired you to write
it? Yeah. Yeah, I was sitting with a group of transpersonal psychologists who's, if you're into that world, you'd recognize their names probably. Walsh was one. Not getting too old to think of all of them, but they're all famous at the time. Probably half of them are still famous, the other half are dead. Yeah, they found it helpful. And mostly I find the practitioners like it because it puts Nagarjuna in context. And scholars don't like it because it's not scholarly enough for them. I don't care. Okay, thank you so much. We've run late. Thank you for coming. I hope it was useful.
answer my question?
Yes, of course you can.
Brett Anderson was just about a lot, so that's kind of great. And he was sort of going over these three things.